Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian. In this hour, churches and congregations are facing decreased attendance and low enthusiasm from younger populations. How has civic engagement built their numbers? Doug Becker explores with the author of a new book on the topic. And first, from 1980, the religious right or Christian nationalists helped elect Ronald Reagan and has been a significant voting bloc ever since. How has it become such a powerful force in American politics? And what exactly is its political agenda? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The so-called religious right has been a feature of American politics since the 1970s. Their rise aided in the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, and they've been a significant voting bloc ever since. But how much is this movement, which is better described as an embrace of Christian nationalism, driving American politics? How organized are the groups that comprise the movement? What exactly is its political agenda, and what is its role in the rise of Donald Trump and so-called Trumpism in the Republican Party? Catherine Stewart is author of a new book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. She is an investigative reporter, an author who's covered religious liberty, politics, policy, and education for over a decade. She's also the author of The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. Thank you very much, Catherine Stewart, for joining us. Your book details the rise of the religious right or of Christian nationalism. What are we talking about when we talk about the religious right?
The religious right is, or as I often call it, the Christian nationalist movement, is Christian nationalism is both an ideology and it's the idea that America was founded as a so-called Christian nation, and right-thinking folks or the true Americans need to take it back. But it's also a means of mobilizing and often manipulating the American public, getting people to vote for hyper-conservative political candidates the movement favors, and thereby concentrating power in the hands of a new elite. There are a lot of different terms that people have used over time to describe this movement. And the term religious right, which sort of was involved in the genesis of the Christian nation identity in its current form, it really, I would say, it got a certain kind of loft in the Cold War. Of course, you know, it had earlier iterations, but the one that matters and the one that is the one that really started, I think, gained force in the Cold War. And there's been a kind of subtle but really important shift in how it operates today. It changes the way that Christian identity relates to nationalism. So if you don't mind, I'd like to talk a little bit about that. In the Cold War, there was this strongly felt need to contrast the American way of life with the communist way. And that led to a belief that it was really important to define and cultivate a distinct American identity. Christianity definitely played a part in that, because the one thing that was supposed to distinguish Americans is, you know, we're a godly nation and they're godless. So a lot of the bad fake history that we're seeing today and fable making coming from people like David Barton, who's one of the movement's leading pseudo historians, those ideas sort of originated in that period where they put one nation under God and sort of anathematized godless communists and called America a so-called Christian nation. You know, it has shifted over time. Back then, this idea of a Christian nation was much broader in a way. It didn't exclude people like liberal Christians like Unitarians and United Methodists and the UCC. Even when Eisenhower put, you know, even when In God We Trust was put on our money, it was sort of outward facing. It was more like we are against the communists who, frankly, you know, the Soviet Union deserved the challenges to its dysfunction and corruption. But there was still a nasty side to that in the attack on, quote, godless communists as a way of attacking forces of progress within the United States itself. So, you know, reactionaries would red bait and start attacking people from within. And I think that sort of kind of attacking people from within is a significant shift. As I said, it used to be a way of consolidating a sort of loosely defined national identity against a kind of communist or an other that was more of a geopolitical enemy. And today, the Christian nationalism tends to be a way of dividing Americans between insider and outsider, pure and impure.
And you raise this interesting question about liberal Christians. At the beginning of the book, you say this is not a book about the so-called religious left. It's actually specifically about Christian nationalism and religious rights. But I mean, religion's always played this role in American politics. I think of, you know, even the discourses about how the churches play a political role immediately gets turned to the role the churches played in the civil rights movement. And one of the reasons why there was the sense that there should be some tolerance of religious participation in politics because they're leading, you know, they're leading civil rights. What ultimately leads to this religious identity as largely being on the right wing of American politics? Because I mean, there are still Christian left groups, but they're nowhere near as powerful as the religious right groups.
They're not as It's powerful because they're not candidate focused. They tend to want to respect their, you know, their tax status, their tax privileges. They're not organized, whereas the religious right leaders have invested for decades in all of the infrastructure of building what is essentially kind of a modern political a political campaign. They've invested in data and media, legislative initiatives, right-wing policy groups, networking groups that get the leadership of the various components of the infrastructure all on the same page. And the religious left certainly hasn't done that. And I think if we look back with the rise of the civil rights era, you know, a lot of the religious left groups played a critical role in promoting civil rights and expansion, you know, greater equality and things like that. But then the religious right, the reactionary religious nationalists were much more allied with sort of, it was like a marriage between reactionary positions and so-called culture wars and right-wing economics. So the idea of their idea of America as a Christian nation actually became harsher and more demanding. All of a sudden you had to be a Bible believer, sort of biblical literalist as they understood it, in order to count as a proper Christian. So in their view, you know, the liberal United Methodists and liberal Catholics and Unitarians and, you know, UCC were not really part of their movement at all.
Now, one figure that you do focus on, you got, you know, numerous chapters on different figures, but one that particularly fascinated me as a child of the Midwest is Phyllis Schlafly, partially because, you know, coming from the Midwest, also as a woman's voice, because a lot of times you think of these evangelical communities as largely being men's voices, but as a woman's voice, what role did Phyllis Schlafly play in the advancement of this religious right?
Well, she's such a fascinating character. I'm so glad you asked about her. Well, let's just go back a little bit to the late 1970s. There was a rise of a movement called the New Right. And people like Paul Weyrich, Schlafly, Howard Phillips, Alan Dye, and others, they felt the Republican Party had become too liberal. They felt like it was too soft on communism. As we all know, anti-communism was a huge animating factor for Schlafly herself. But they were upset about the civil rights era, the, you know, racial equality, desegregated schools, the rise of the women's rights movement and things like that. And they wanted to drag the Republican Party to the right. They want to ignite a hyper-conservative counter-revolution. And they thought about like a number of issues that could be used to unite their movement. And abortion, frankly, wasn't the first issue. The big thing that sort of got them up in the morning was the threat that tax privileges might be taken away for segregated schools. People like Bob Jones and Jerry Falwell and other Southern preachers had been leading these, sort of involved in these schools that were segregated by race and also religious. And they really were offended that the IRS was starting to like look at them and scratch its head and say, well, why are we giving tax privileges to segregation? But movement leaders, they knew this wasn't going to really be a very attractive issue. This is sort of a long way around talking about Phyllis Schlafly, and I'm going to get to her. I'm sorry about that. So they settled on abortion, you know, as the issue that could unite conservative Protestants, conservative Catholics. And by the way, Phyllis Schlafly was Catholic. Also, although she kind of kept it a little quiet about it, because at the time, Catholics and Protestants were often on, there was a lot of sort of tension among the different groupings, particularly around the issues about school prayer and things like that. And they knew they could bring in a lot of sort of fundamentalists. I think Howard Phillips said, we can even draw in some of our fundamentalist, you know, fringe fundamentalists to the movement. So they settled on abortion as this issue that could be used to unite their new movement because they knew very well if you can get people to vote on a single issue, you can control their vote, or one or two issues. So all of a sudden, the Parvet, you know, they sort of pivoted to sort of getting, you know, purging the Republican Party of pro-choice voices. And Phyllis Schlafly, here's the thing, she wrote a really extraordinary book about that. It's called How the Republican Party Became Pro-Life. And it describes about a 15, 20-year period from when most Protestant Republicans supported abortion rights. And she describes how they purged these pro-choice voices from the Republican Party in order to draw in, you know, to create this unity among conservative Catholics and conservative Protestants. Other Catholic figures who played big roles in this were George Weigel. The name is escaping me right now. I apologize for that. There was like a group that called themselves theoconservatives. So she really played an enormous role in making that unity happen. And so she was a very important figure. You know what's really interesting about Schlafly? She saw her opposition to the ERA and the women's rights movement as a means of defending women's dignity within an inherently and sort of eternally patriarchal order. She has a kind of quote where she says, I'm going to paraphrase here. She said, because women have to bear the consequences of the sex act and, you know, have children, men have to be essentially, I'm paraphrasing again, you know, forced to bear the consequences in other ways, providing for the woman and his children, et cetera. I think she had this idea that men without sex leading to pregnancy and children, men would sort of just go off and abandon their responsibilities. Now, of course, we know that this just doesn't work. It was also imagining that, you know, the entire country was sort of this middle or upper middle class, living in this upper middle class utopia where every family could, you know, get by on a single salary with dignity. And of course that, you know, women didn't have aspirations beyond just baby making and homemaking. So, you know, it's deeply unrealistic. And of course, many people have pointed to the fact that she herself was a powerhouse and had a very big career. So she was certainly, you know, fulfilling her efforts, her desire to be meaningful out there in the world. But, you know, it's interesting to when you look at her thinking.
You actually now have presented a little bit of a quandary for the Republican Party, you know, at least, and the role the religious right, you know, is playing here, because you've got these cultural conservatives and waging, nowadays we call these the culture wars, but that kind of butting heads with another key component, you know, of the coalition that's voting Republican, and that's libertarians that would be concerned with the government outlawing abortion or, you know, the role that the church might be playing in all of this. But you highlight the marriage between the religious right and economic conservatism, the idea of low taxes, et cetera, which is not necessarily natural from a kind of a biblical perspective. How did that happen, that linkage between economic conservatism and these culturally conservative movements?
Well, that happened over time, but you know, it's a really deep synthesis and it's really important to the movement. The movement derives a tremendous amount of support from extremely like plutocratic funders, people like the Prince DeVos family and the Lindsays and the Greens and so many other, you know, McClellan. There's so many other organizations and, you know, and families that I write about as big funders of the movement, the Mercers, et cetera, et cetera. And these folks are as committed, if not more committed to far-right economic policy, you know, as they are positions in the culture war. So what they really want is low taxes or sometimes no taxes for the rich, minimal regulation of government, minimal rights for the workforce. So this is it's a conundrum. So, you know, this is a movement that claims to stand for family values, but yet they're endorsing, you know, they're driving support for politicians who endorse economic policies that are making it so much harder for so many American families to succeed. You know, in advance of the 2020 election, I saw Franklin Graham give a sort of speech in favor of Trump. And he said, well, we like Trump because he's nostalgic for the 1950s and early 1960s. And we're nostalgic for the 1950s and the early 1960s too. So that's why we support him. I thought, okay. Late, you know, 1950s, early 1960s. Let's look at what's happening economically. At that time, the average CEO made, I think it was, I don't have to figure, like something like 21 times the amount of the average worker. So you could join a country club and have a boat, maybe a second house. You could do very well. You could live very well as a CEO. And, the workforce, you know, maybe there were unions and people could, families could survive on a single salary and, you could afford your own home, et cetera. Well, today, the average CEO of a Fortune 500 company earns nearly 400 times the amount of the average worker in their workforce. And what it shows is like we're living in an era of record economic inequality. And this is not like an opinion. You look at the sociological data, the economic data, and it really is creating a real challenge for a lot of American families to make ends meet, to support their children in a way that's with dignity. So that sort of synthesis is very deep. And we could talk about the history of it. We could talk about James Fifield and spiritual mobilization. We could talk about sort of some of its later iterations. But if you just look at some of these big funders of the religious right today, they know you can't get people to vote on these economic policies that are going to disempower themselves, degrade their healthcare, degrade the kinds of education that their children are receiving, but you can get them to vote on abortion, same-sex marriage, or some whatever trans issues that, probably don't affect their community, but, provide a good, way to sort of focus people's fear and et cetera. So, I think of those culture war issues as, again, the shiny baubles that the movement leaders use to get people to say, it's like if you have a dog and you say, there's a squirrel, and your dog, goes running off. It's sort of, it's just a distraction in many regards.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing a new book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, with its author, Catherine Stewart. So, in 2016, a candidate for president, twice divorced, crude in his language, admitting to adultery, admitting to aggression, sexual aggression against women, becomes a favorite of the Republican Party. And in particular, as your book highlights, suggestions that Donald Trump's election was not just something because he favors policies that we favor, but almost anointed by God. How does that happen?
Well, some of it is transactional because he promised to appoint pro-life judges, pro-life being a kind of shorthand for judges that are going to agree with their agenda. He took in Mike Pence, of course, as his number two, saying, look, I'm going to work with you. And then in advance of the election, he sort of promised to form an evangelical council. And look, he threw open the doors to them. He gave them unprecedented access to public money, I think to a largely underappreciated degree. This is a movement that's very sort of focused on gaining access to public money. So he enacted policies that were favorable to their agenda, privileged people with certain sort of correct viewpoints over others. So there's that part of it. Now, over the years, been going to all these right-wing strategy gatherings and meetings and summits. And at every single one, Trump or his surrogates will say, he'll literally get up there and say, I think I've given you everything you wanted. And in fact, I think I've given you more. And everyone stands up and applauds. Okay, so here's the part of it that I think is really underappreciated. I think he represents the lawlessness of the authoritarian. So I think that they actually, many of them really like his style. He doesn't respect the laws. He's a law unto himself. And he, this is a, it's perfect representative of a movement that doesn't believe in equality or pluralism or the best of the American promise, and really believes that a right-thinking minority or elite should be dominating over everybody else, and wants to enact certain privileges for certain groups and have the right to sort of direct hate and contempt toward other groups. So, they've convinced the rank and file that they're engaged in an apocalyptic struggle between absolute good and absolute evil. And if you're engaged in a struggle with Satan, which they sometimes say, you know, they sometimes refer to Democrats or Democratic organizations as demonic or satanic, you don't, you know, want the nice guy who's going to sort of negotiate. You want the mean guy who's going to crack heads, as long as those heads belong to your political enemies.
One of my observations about Donald Trump is that at the end of the day, he represents a truly masculinist approach, that this is, you know, the kind of the big man, the strong man. And so certainly one group that he is directly opposed to are feminists, are women's empowerment, and not just women's rights, but kind of a more feminine approach to politics, which frankly, Democrats have embraced quite a bit, certainly since Bill Clinton.
Because in an earlier era, masculinity was associated with self-control, with dignity, with being able to speak well and comport oneself with a measure of strength, personal strength, not just brutes acting like a, you know, an overgrown second grader or whatever. So I think, you know, we can look at it a certain kind of representing a certain kind of machismo, but it really flies in the face of a kind of historic idea of what masculine dignity really was.
But that does remind me, you have a quote from Jerry Falwell saying that Jesus wasn't weak. In fact, I'll use the word you use, that Jesus wasn't pussified, that he was strong, he was masculine, he was, you know, he was yeah. Cut. Is that consistent throughout the movement, or is that just a couple of individuals that are kind of focusing on the even just the physicality of Jesus and strength, physical strength, muscular Christianity? We always used to refer to that with things like the YMCA movement.
There's a lot of that now throughout the movement. And I'm sure you're familiar with the work of Kristen Cobus-Gemez. She talks about how the movement has embraced this idea of sort of militarism and machismo. And it's actually a reaction to what Christianity, sort of liberal Christianity, liberal Protestantism had become when folks like Paul Tillich and Niebuhr were sort of their idea, they sort of married the idea of a Christianity with social gospel, which emphasizes social gospel, and was very concerned about, you know, loving your neighbor and doing good, you know, good things for society. I mean, that was really part of what the new right was acting against. They were very, you know, disappointed with that. I mean, ironically, if you look at somebody like Jimmy Carter, he was an evangelical and he was very focused on social gospel in a way. He was an embodiment of where a lot of Protestant religion was at the time. And, you know, new right leaders and other sort of folks like Falwell, who represented a much more, I would say, reactionary and severe strain of Christian identity, wanted to diminish their influence in society. And that's where a lot of the, you know, animus for the religious right came from in an earlier era.
Now, another theme you take on in the book is the question of race, because we have this idea of the religious right, and particularly of Christian nationalism, which is really the way that you frame this, as being a white movement. But you challenge that, you know, in many ways. And actually the 2020 electoral returns suggested that as well. Donald Trump did better among Hispanic communities and African-American communities than previous Republicans had. Can you talk a little bit about the racial elements within the movement?
I think for a lot of the white people in the movement is implicitly white, if not explicitly, because it harkens back to an idea of America that was once supposedly all Christian, Bible thumping in their view, and implicitly white. But the movement, and of course the movement can't separate itself from its racist past, because it got a lot of support from pro-segregationist preachers, folks like Bob Jones, and even in an earlier era from, you know, the pro-slavery theologians who embraced this idea of America's an authentically Christian nation, laws rooted in the Bible, and hierarchies rooted in God's will. But here's the big but. Movement leaders can see the future, the demographic future, as clearly as you or I can. And they recognize that if their movement is just white, they will they may lose key elections. So and some of the, you know, further thinking leaders have made efforts in recent years to reach out to pastors of color and particularly of denominations like Pentecostal and charismatic denominations that have large percentages of, you know, like Latino Latino Americans and Black Americans and people of color, in order to sort of try to, number one, improve the appearance of diversity in their movement and also draw in voters that they can sort of mint new voters. So we saw the consequences in the last election where you had Trump focusing and the GOP focusing on many Latino majority churches in places like South Florida, throughout Florida, really, in places like Texas as well. And then you saw the dial move in significant ways. I think it was between 2016 and 2020, Latino voters overall moved 8 to 10 points in Trump's favor. And a lot of that, you know, a lot of that sort of stuff happened in Latino majority churches. There's a woman named Nilsa Alvarez. She does Latino outreach for the GOP. And at a conference I attended, she said, every single county that we focused on went majority red. So it's fascinating. And then Biden, he improved, I think 3 points it was among white voters overall. So, you know, that's not to say that there's not a lot of both implicit and explicit racism within the movement. We can see this in the sort of anti-CRT race baiting, where they're calling everything relating to America, you know, the teaching of America's real history of slavery, segregation, racial redlining, all of that. They're calling it CRT. This is our history. You know, Christopher Rufo, who is works at the Manhattan Institute, and this is the architect of the sort of anti-CRT new culture war that they've got going on. He said, we're just going to call everything that we don't like CRT, and we're going to, you know, tar their brand with a CRT label. But we all know it's race baiting.
Absolutely. And that serves as a perfect transition to the last big point I want to raise. Your chapter 6 is entitled The Use and Abuse of History, which, by the way, is very near and dear to my heart and my own research, my interest in historical memory questions. The context of this is legal battles, Supreme Court battles over the so-called original intent and the way in which issues get framed as to framers' interests, framer identity. And one of the things you point out is that the Christian nationalist movement positions the framers, the founders of the state, as Christians. How much is that in a use and abuse of history?
Well, it's an abuse of history. I mean, our framers, you know, had different views on religion, but many of them were unabashedly deists, and they unabashedly created the world's first secular republic. The Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which is interpreted to ensure the separation of church and state, a phrase that actually flowed from Thomas Jefferson's pen. It has the best piece of real estate in our Constitution. It's the first clause of the First Amendment. So I don't understand why. I mean, I do understand they want power and they want money and all the other things, but, you know, we have to face the fact that our nation is irreducibly pluralistic. And in a nation as irreducibly pluralistic as ours, you cannot have peace without having a certain separation of church and state. Now, that doesn't mean people can't freely practice their faith and don't have the right to worship any god or none, or even express their religious views in the public square, especially, you know, as I think politicians can do that while still acknowledging the diversity of our country and respecting others who do not wish to be compelled to pray or participate in any religion if they don't want to, or be compelled to fund any religion that they don't want to with their tax dollars. But, you know, in the hands of religious nationalists in America, this has all been turned on its head. They view the idea of religious liberty as the right to get tax money, and, you know, in addition to the many tax privileges they already enjoy, but to have their initiatives funded by the taxpayer to draw on the public trough. And then they also interpret it as the right of people with certain supposedly correct religious beliefs to direct their hate and contempt toward others and to sort of, you know, enjoy certain privileges, to use the idea of, you know, religious liberty is almost like a get out of jail free card. and a way of exempting them from the laws that apply to everyone else.
It's a great place to end this conversation. The title of the book is The Power Worshippers: Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. The author is Catherine Stewart. She's been our guest today talking about the book. She's an investigative reporter and author covering issues of religious liberty, politics, policy, and education. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
When we come back, since the pandemic, churches have faced a real challenge of disengagement. But what has civic engagement done for the church and the community? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Civic and political engagement has made religion meaningful for its members and has had positive influence on the community. Doug Becker explores how and why.
I'm Doug Becker. Churches in America face serious challenges. Their numbers are declining. Populations are less engaged. And politically, they're identified as partisan institutions. Many people see churches as tied to the Republican Party, Republican interests and issues. But the key to religious growth and revival and the thriving of these congregations and communities is engagement. Their role in the larger community as social, economic, political actors is often what can lead them to success and also seemingly a more meaningful relationship within the church, among individuals, and with the community at large. On today's show, we're going to discuss the challenges these religious congregations face, proposals to overcome these challenges, and the importance of engagement of religious communities. Our guest today is Rebecca Glazer. She's professor in the School of Public Affairs at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock and a member of the Middle East Studies faculty. And she's written a new book entitled Faith and Community: How Engagement Strengthens Members, Places of Worship, and Society. Rebecca, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Doug. It's my joy to be here.
Absolutely. So first, let's start with some of the challenges the congregations are facing. What are the biggest challenges that these religious communities, these religious congregations are facing? And what's kind of been the cause of that?
I think there are some big challenges in front of congregations today. And one of the major ones is declining attendance. So a lot of places of worship have been seeing their declining attendance drop over recent years, and especially it's dropping among younger members. And so that's hitting them really hard, both in terms of people in the pews, the people that they're seeing being active and engaged in their congregation, and also just in terms of being able to keep the lights on, keep their clergy employed. And it can be hard to stay a congregation when you don't have people who are showing up. And COVID really hit a lot of congregations especially hard. And people haven't been coming back as much to in-person worship services post-COVID as they have been coming back to a lot of their other life activities. And one final thing that you mentioned is politics. A lot of people feel like places of worship are too political. And in such a politically divided society, they might not feel comfortable if they hear something political at church that can really turn them off and make them feel disengaged. So with all of these problems that congregations are facing, my research team and I started looking at how getting engaged in the community can actually be one way to help them address all of these troubles.
One clear challenge that congregations, and I know, you know, your research team and what you were studying was a large number of congregations, but there's been a centralization of a lot of these congregations, especially, I know you're in Arkansas, so I think it's true probably nationally, but certainly in your region of the country, where you get these larger and larger mega churches, these really large congregations. That's got to be having an impact on a number of the moderate, the medium-sized, maybe a little bit smaller congregations. Is there inherent tension between the mega church and the mega pastor in a lot of these congregations that you were researching?
That's a really interesting question. So our study, we really believe in multi-method research. So it's a long-term community-based project focused in the city of Little Rock. So we've been looking both deeply and broadly in Little Rock for 12 years now. And we've been looking at all kinds of churches and congregations, from synagogues, temples, mosques, looking at evangelical churches. We have some mega churches that are part of our sample, looking at Catholics, Muslims, Jews, Mormons, Black churches, white churches here in a racially divided city. Some of them are very small, some are rural, some are big, some are urban. And you do have some congregations that are large and have a lot of resources. And community engagement is going to look very different for those kind of congregations compared to ones that are much smaller and maybe are shrinking or are older. They're going to have to do community engagement very differently. But our sample, one of the things that's really strong about it is that we have such a diverse sample that we included all of these different kinds of congregations and places of worship so that we can understand the differences across them and how they're engaging in the community and what impact that's having on their members and on society.
One of the things that I found fascinating, first of all, I realized how little I know about Little Rock as I was reading that. And so could you describe Little Rock a bit for us? And then also, how typical do you think Little Rock is, cities in the region, you know, cities around the country? How much can you generalize about what you've learned in Little Rock in similar types of communities?
Absolutely. So I came to Little Rock in 2009, and I actually came from California. So it was definitely a change for me to be in Little Rock, Arkansas, from California. I'd never been there before. And one of the first things that happened when I moved to Little Rock was people started asking me if I had a church home. And this is a question that I had definitely never heard living in California, because people didn't very often speak openly about religion or talk about where they were attending church or ask people questions about religion. That felt super personal and even a little bit invasive. But it was very much part of the culture here in Little Rock for people to openly ask you if you had a church home. And so that taught me that both religion was very much a part of the culture here in the Bible Belt. People were very open about it. But also, I think that the way they talked about it, that they spoke of it as a church home, really says a lot about what that means to people here in Little Rock, that your church, your congregation, your place of worship really is a place where you find family, where you find connection, and it really is important and meaningful. So that told me a lot about this place that I had moved to, and I began this research project in 2012. I wanted to get my students out of the classroom and into the community to learn a little bit more and to kind of give back. And so we started doing that work. And I wanted my students to get a better sense of their community. So Little Rock is not that big, maybe 200,000 people within the city limits, but it is racially divided, economically divided. It's a very diverse city. It's almost exactly split in half between Black and white, with a small minority Hispanic population and other non-white population as well. And so Little Rock is also very religious here in the Bible Belt. So it's a great place to study religion and community engagement. And we've been able to learn so much about what's going on here in our community over the last 12 years.
Because you mentioned about what your religion is, you kind of felt it was very personal and very invasive, but people were asking those sorts of questions. So the congregations themselves, I would imagine that there's a division between those that are really very sort of internal, very inward looking, tends to be kind of that small community, versus those that really do seek out within the community and be a part of the community. First of all, is that what you mean by engagement, by civic engagement, that the church is, you know, is reaching out? And in what ways have they done that?
Looking at the congregations that we studied in Little Rock, we know that Little Rock is not going to look exactly like any other city in America or around the world. But we do think that almost any congregation can find themselves in our data and in our case studies. So we have 7 different detailed case studies of different congregations and how they're engaging. So when we talk about community engagement by places of worship, What we're really talking about is anything that is looking beyond their own walls. So there's lots of congregations that do maybe what we would think of as service for their own members. So maybe they do like an event, like maybe an Easter egg hunt or something for their own members, or maybe they take care of their own members when they get sick or are in the hospital or something like that. But a community engaged congregation might open up that Easter egg hunt to all members or all people who are living in that neighborhood to come and participate. Or they might not just visit their own members in the hospital, but they might go visit other people in need in the hospital, or they might set up a meal service for families whose children are getting cancer treatments. So it's looking to serve or to help or to engage with people beyond their own congregation. And there are all kinds of ways to do that. And that's why we have these detailed case studies, so that different congregations can see what that might look like. So for an evangelical congregation that we profile in the book, that engagement might look like building relationships with the neighborhood around their physical location in downtown Little Rock. And part of the reason that they're doing that is because they want to serve, but it's also because they're trying to, as they would put it, share Jesus with the people in the neighborhood. And they're doing that through service. And so there really is an evangelical component to that engagement. But for a Muslim congregation, they do a lot of interfaith work. And part of that is really how they feel about their role in the community as a minority faith in trying to teach others about Islam and trying to dispel any negative stereotypes that might exist. So there's lots of different ways to be engaged.
One of the real themes here is that engagement serves a lot of different purposes, all of which seemingly positive. I guess the first question then is, why is engagement so important for the community, for the congregation itself? What is it about that engagement that helps to build the community, that helps to build the congregation, make it more attractive to other members?
We actually see community engagement as beneficial really for everyone. And we see it at three different levels. We see it benefiting the individual people. So when we surveyed thousands of people across these 12 years, and we saw individual benefits to people having higher life satisfaction, being happier, saying they feel closer to God, having higher levels of political efficacy, meaning that they feel like their voice matters and they can make a difference. And then we also see benefits another level up to the congregation themselves. So people attend more, solving that attendance problem for the congregations when they're engaged in the community. And they're giving more to their congregations as well. And they have warmer feelings towards the congregation. So they're more likely to say things like, my congregation feels like family, and I would want to invite people to attend this congregation with me. And they're more likely also to serve at their congregation. So when talking with clergy, sometimes they feel like maybe there would be a trade-off, right? If we ask our members to go do this service project for Habitat for Humanity, then they're going to be too tired or tapped out to set up chairs for the fish fry next weekend. But it turns out that that's not the case. In the data instead, we see that serving creates a culture of service. And when you do more community engagement, you get more service to the congregation as well. So you see those benefits accruing to the congregation. And then again, we see it aggregate up to society. So not only do you have real tangible benefits to society, things like food pantries provided, volunteers for the Habitat for Humanity project, but you also have those higher levels of political efficacy. So you have people who, instead of feeling jaded and checked out of politics, are attending community meetings, are talking with their neighbors and friends about political issues, are going out and voting. Also, we see people who, when they're in ideologically diverse congregations, actually feeling that greater sense of efficacy as well. So places of worship can actually bring people together in this politically divided world and help them feel like their voice matters and that they can participate and make a difference.
You're talking about very, very different religious traditions, from Protestant to Catholic and Muslim and Jewish, et cetera. When we think of religion, we think of it as being such a divisive identity. There's so much conflict over religions and so much ill will from people of different, you know, faith communities. Do these congregations tend to cooperate on some of these engagement projects? And did you find that through civic engagement, the different congregations themselves cooperated? So this process, where you find this ideological diversity, maybe even religious diversity within the congregation, could also be more of a community diversity of religious peoples, irrespective of what their religious background is.
Yeah, you know what, Doug? I think that this is a place where there's a real potential for growth. This is something that surprised me a lot, because we ended up talking with a lot of different congregations and actually ended up talking with a lot of different nonprofits too, because we found that a lot of congregations and a lot of nonprofits were sometimes working to solve the same issues. They were sometimes working on homelessness or working on hunger or working on addiction, and were kind of working in parallel and not always collaborating with one another. And we did a special survey in 2018 just to talk about collaboration and about barriers to collaboration. And we interviewed dozens and dozens of leaders of congregations on this. And what we found was that there's actually a lot of barriers to collaboration. And some of that comes from fear. It comes from fear of sheep stealing, fear that if you collaborate with another congregation, that they might think, oh, well, this is kind of a nice congregation, maybe I'll start attending over there, and that you'll lose members. There's a desire to have your congregation's name on a project, and so you don't want to collaborate because you want this to be your food pantry, not one that you work on with someone else. And so there's actually a lot less collaboration than there could be.
Now, does the political outlook of the congregation, because obviously there's some congregations that tend to be much more progressive, others that tend to be, you know, much more conservative. Does the nature of the engagement change depending on the congregation, or is the type of service that they're engaged in pretty consistent irrespective of, say, you know, what the beliefs are and where that might fall, say, on the political spectrum?
Yeah, we do see differences in the type of engagement and the type of services that are provided, depending on what the majority ideological affiliation of the congregations are. You do see more conservative, both ideologically and spiritually conservative congregations focusing on like marriage and family issues. There's a big foster care nonprofit working in Little Rock. And so there's a big focus on that in a lot of the congregations, and providing kind of marriage counseling and family services and things like that. Also more of a focus on education as well, in those more conservative congregations.
And then you had suggested that some of this question about engagement certainly helps to address the generational issues. I've been in churches where I am a little older, middle-aged, but I was clearly the youngest person in the congregation versus the younger congregations, families, you know, et cetera. Is there a direct linkage between this type of civic engagement and popularity among younger people? The sense that if younger people might be trying to figure out where exactly they are, they're on a bit of a spiritual journey, that the engagement really becomes a way to re-engage or make these religious communities more important in their lives.
Yeah, this is one of the findings that we were really excited about, because in the latest survey that we did, we asked the congregants to tell us how important a variety of community issues were to them. And then we followed up and said, okay, you said that was an important issue, but would you want your congregation to get involved in working to solve that issue? So maybe you think crime is an important issue, but it's not an issue that you want your congregation involved in. But you say that education is an important issue, but you want your congregation to do something about that. And then if they said they wanted their congregation involved in it, we asked another follow-up question that said, would you be willing to volunteer on this issue? And almost across the board on almost every single issue, it was people who were 40 and younger who were statistically significantly more likely to say they would volunteer than any other age cohort. So those younger people, sometimes we think that it's the people who are retired who are more likely to volunteer and be active. And actually, there's lots of data out there that says that those are the people who are more likely to be volunteering. But in this context, at congregations, these younger people are so ready to be engaged. They are so much want their places of worship to do something more than just worship services. They want to be active. They want greater meaning in their lives and in their worship, that they're ready to volunteer on basically almost any issue. They just want to dive in and get involved. So we really saw a lot of excitement and willingness to act from the younger generations.
And the title suggests it strengthens members, places of worship. What about society as a whole? This engagement you're talking about, a lot of this is very service-oriented. You know, you talk about things like food kitchens and church I was working with spent a lot of time on homelessness issues, you know, providing resources for the homeless, that sort of thing. How much of an impact are these religious communities having within the community itself? Bit of a public policy question. Are you seeing within Little Rock, this is having a real positive impact on a number of the challenges the city faces?
Yeah, I think it's hard to say that the social problems are going to be solved by congregations. They're certainly doing some good in the communities and helping to address these needs. But I think as a political scientist and a social scientist, the things that we're able to measure are a little more about how the people themselves are being changed by their engagement. And what we're seeing there is changes in social capital, which we know is really important for societies to function well and for democracies to function well, and political efficacy. So what this engagement is doing is it's helping people be more connected to their communities. And if we talk to public health researchers, they'll tell you that loneliness is a public health epidemic that is more dangerous than smoking or obesity, that it is having detrimental effects on people's physical and mental health. And what being part of community engaged congregations does is it counters that and it builds social capital for people. And we can measure that in the data, and we see that in physical, mental, and life satisfaction health outcomes. And what else it does is it improves political efficacy. And that's what's good for democracy, is it leads people to be less jaded and checked out of politics and more engaged and participatory.
And also, I don't know that you've done this research, so you may tell me this is next stage of this. If the community's working on a specific issue, so if it's working on hunger, or if it's working on poverty, homelessness, et cetera, that the process of that work also alters political preferences. So not necessarily conservative becomes liberal, liberal becomes conservative, but these issues become all the more important in the expectation that there's some sort of policy, some sort of action done by the government. You care more about homelessness if you work with homeless populations. It seems intuitive. Does that bear out in the data, or have you done that research?
We haven't specifically been able to follow up with congregations to see over time how they're changing. But what we did see actually in the data from 2020 was when we asked people about what issues were most important to them, we saw that education and health and marriage and family were our top three, and race relations was the number four issue. But then we asked that follow-up question where we said, do you want your congregation to get involved in this? And the number one issue that people wanted their place of worship to get involved in helping to address was race relations. And we think that that really told us something important about where people see their place of worship as prepared and in a place to engage with and having the resources to engage with. And so especially in 2020, when America was reeling after this summer of racial justice, people saw the resources of religion as able to address the challenges of race relations, and they wanted it to address that. And we actually had a clergy advisory board, which we still have and are very grateful for their input, that told us that they wanted more questions about race on our survey before 2020 even happened. So in 2019, our religious leaders summit told us we need to talk about race more. And so we had those questions on our survey before George Floyd was murdered. And we were able to have that data that showed how important it was to people. So we think that clergy talking about it and having it on the minds of their congregation kind of led to us seeing that data in addition to the current events. We also have a lot of qualitative data. So I guess one political efficacy story that I'll tell you comes from after 2021 and the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. There were a number of families, refugee families, that needed to be placed. And there were congregations in Little Rock that placed 12 refugee families and kind of adopted and took care of them. So there were big congregations that maybe took one or two families on, and there were smaller congregations that worked together to take care of a family together. And they organized meals, they found homes, they put together furniture, they found them used cars, they worked to find them jobs, they did kindergarten carpool, they worked so hard to care for these families and take them to medical appointments and do English tutoring with them. They showed me giant spreadsheets of all the, you know, 50 plus coordinators and people working to help care for these families at these different congregations. And that took what was an abstract problem, the U.S. withdrawing from Afghanistan, all of these refugees that needed help. And they really felt a sense of efficacy in helping these people. And someone told me, you know, it's one thing to do a one-off service project, but these were our families and they really built relationships with them. So that was them putting that efficacy into practice.
I think it's a wonderful place to stop. Our guest has been Rebecca Glazer. She's professor in the School of Public Affairs at the University of Arkansas, Little Rock, member of the Middle East Studies faculty. And she's written a new book. It's entitled Faith and Community, How Engagement Strengthens Members, Places of Worship in Society. Rebecca, thank you so much for your time and sharing the narrative and the research that you've done on this issue.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Mahika Chechi is our assistant producer. Seth Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.